Because he stole Rosina from Peregrine, and because Peregrine pushed Charles into Min's cauldron and James could not resist expending superhuman effort to rescue him, then had to rest for days, he was unable to prevent Titus from drowning, or to summon the strength to administer the kiss of life at the right moment when Titus is found. This failure is so bitter that James almost disappears from under Charles's gaze. He paces about near the tower among the rocks as if measuring something out. This is part of James's agon, to suffer to the dregs the resemblance between the loss of Titus and the loss of his Sherpa during a Himalayan blizzard. The ego of the adept also leads to sin. There is a teaching in Buddhism that suggests a more than personal goal for the bodhisattva or Buddha in training. It is that by delaying his departure from life, he may acquire merit and transfer it to another otherwise less worthy person. The Teshu Lama does this for Kim at the end of the Kipling novel. James has unnaturally protracted his own limbo period out of love for Charles, who interprets James's beliefs somewhat too narrowly, but with chastened rue, as his cousin's desire to tidy up an attachment that would hamper him. Partial, like so many of Charles's insights, it nevertheless recognizes in a scrambled way that he figured largely in James's life, and that James was a profoundly troubled as well as gifted soul. Dr. Tsang, who informs Charles of James's death, is also from Dehradun in the foothills of the Himalayan range separating northern India from Tibet, presumably also a Buddhist, and someone who recognizes in the willed manner of James's peaceful death the act of an enlightened one who died achieving all. Undeniably, part of Charles's change is that he knows how much he has lost. With hindsight, we can see that the one great light toward whom Charles has been wending in the dark cavern has been his cousin. I remembered that James was dead. Who is one's first love? Who indeed? During the last third of the novel, both James and Charles Arrowby enter the realm of their separate ordeals. We see James's indirectly, because Charles cannot see directly into it at the time. Illusions are methodically, if violently, stripped away. Each goes beyond himself. Each abjures magic, which Murdoch defines in her work on Plato as the fantastic doctoring of the real for consumption by the private ego. This could almost be a definition of novel writing. Magic, ego, illusion, all of these terms, like the dust that falls on their possessions, come to rest with a difference on James, a more advanced being, than on Charles. But the torment of facing all the loss for the one who remains is no less Marcius-like for that. And if Murdoch's fictional sophist were to cry, "That's poetic, just a metaphor," perhaps her Socrates could again be summoned to remind the reader that there are deep metaphors. Perhaps there are bottomless metaphors. Mary Kinsey. Notes. Tom Phillips's painting is in the National Portrait Gallery, London. Easier to get to than Titian's The Flaying of Marcius, which is in a former archiepiscopal palace in Kroměříž, Czechoslovakia. However, the Titian can now be accessed on the web at artchive.com, and the Phillips portrait appears as a stamp-sized icon on the back of many of the Penguin paper editions of Murdoch's novels. For help in thinking about the Titian painting, I am indebted to Renaissance art historian Laura Giles of the Art Institute of Chicago, who provided me with the essential essay on this work by Sidney J. Friedberg from FMR, Volume 4, 1984. Robert Hughes's quip appears in his essay, The Legacy of La Serenissima, on the Royal Academy of Art's London show, The Genius of Venice, 1500 to 1600. Time, 6th February, 1984. This show brought to London the flaying of Marsyas, although Murdoch had earlier written of the painting in both The Black Prince, 1973, and A Fairly Honorable Defeat, 1970. Robert Graves's two-volume work on Greek myths, Penguin, 1955, provided material about both Marsyas and Perseus when it did not appear in Ovid and Dante. Linguist Seymour Chapman's suggestion about an interest point of view appears in his chapter on non-narrated stories in his Story and Discourse, Narrative Structure in Fiction and Film, Cornell University Press, 1978. Reprinted in Essentials of the Theory of Fiction, Editors Hoffman and Murphy, Duke University Press, 1990. Quotations from Murdoch's philosophical and critical prose and her Platonic dialogues are taken from the invaluable indexed compendium edited by Peter Conradi, Existentialists and Mystics, Writings on Philosophy and Literature by Iris Murdoch, Penguin, 1998. Professor of Philosophy Julius Sensat provided the source for the quotation from David Hume's Treatise of Human Nature, Book 2, of the Passions, Part 3, of the Will and Direct Passions, Section 3, of the Influencing Motives of the Will, and helpfully explained its context. Jorge Luis Borges's remark about Tacitus appears in his essay, The Modesty of History, Other Inquisitions, 1937 to 1952. I was guided throughout by Elizabeth Dipple's Iris Murdoch, Work for the Spirit, University of Chicago Press, 1982, a study of all of Murdoch's novels through Nuns and Soldiers, 1980, the novel that followed the Sea, 1978. These 20 novels would be followed by 5 more enormous books, The Philosopher's Pupil, 1983, The Underappreciated, The Good Apprentice, 1985, The Book and the Brotherhood, 1987, The Message to the Planet, 1989, and The Green Knight, 1993, and then the mysterious and brief postscript to her novel writing career, Jackson's Dilemma, 1995. Only in The Book and the Brotherhood would Murdoch create additional central characters as resistant to self-scrutiny, yet as blindly self-regarding and as sunken into the bog of late middle age as Charles Arrowby. But unlike them, Arrowby, for all his grievous faults, suggests the possibility of insight and the sheer human energy for change.
Prehistory. The sea which lies before me as I write glows, rather than sparkles, in the bland May sunshine. With the tide turning, it leans quietly against the land, almost unflecked by ripples or by foam. Near to the horizon it is a luxurious purple, spotted with regular lines of emerald green. At the horizon it is indigo. Near to the shore, where my view is framed by rising heaps of humpy yellow rock, there is a band of lighter green, icy and pure, less radiant. Opaque, however, not transparent. We are in the north, and the bright sunshine cannot penetrate the sea. Where the gentle water taps the rocks, there is still a surface skin of colour. The cloudless sky is very pale at the indigo horizon, which it lightly pencils in with silver. Its blue gains towards the zenith and vibrates there. But the sky looks cold. Even the sun looks cold. I had written the above, destined to be the opening paragraph of my memoirs, when something happened which was so extraordinary and so horrible that I cannot bring myself to describe it even now, after an interval of time, and although a possible, though not totally reassuring, explanation has occurred to me. Perhaps I shall feel calmer and more clear-headed after yet another interval. I spoke of a memoir. Is that what this chronicle will prove to be? Time will show. At this moment, a page old, it feels more like a diary than a memoir. Well, let it be a diary, then. How I regret that I did not keep one earlier. What a record that would have been! But now the main events of my life are over, and there is to be nothing but recollection in tranquillity. To repent of a life of egoism? Not exactly. Yet something of the sort. Of course, I never said this to the ladies and gentlemen of the theatre. They would never have stopped laughing. The theatre is certainly a place for learning about the brevity of human glory. All those wonderful, glittering, absolutely vanished pantomimes. Now I shall abjure magic and become a hermit. Put myself in a situation where I can honestly say that I have nothing else to do but to learn to be good. The end of life is rightly thought of as a period of meditation. Will I be sorry that I did not begin it sooner? It is necessary to write, that much is clear, and to write in a way quite unlike any way which I have employed before. What I wrote before was written in water, and deliberately so. This is for permanence, something which cannot help hoping to endure. Yes, already I personify the object, the little book, the libellus, this creature to which I am giving life, and which seems at once to have a will of its own. It wants to live. It wants to survive. I have considered writing a journal, not of happenings, for there will be none, but as a record of mingled thoughts and daily observations. My philosophy, my pensées against the background of simple descriptions of the weather and other natural phenomena. This now seems to me again to be a good idea. The sea. I could fill a volume simply with my word pictures of it. I would certainly like to write some sustained account of my surroundings, its flora and fauna. This could be of some interest if I persevered, even though I am no White of Selborne. From my sea-facing window at this moment I can see three different kinds of gulls, swallows, a cormorant, innumerable butterflies drifting about over the flowers which grow miraculously upon my yellow rocks. I must make no attempt at fine writing, however. That would be to spoil my enterprise. Besides, I should merely make a fool of myself. Oh, blessed northern sea! A real sea with clean, merciful tides, not like the stinking, soupy Mediterranean. They say there are seals here, but I have seen none yet. Of course, there is no need to separate memoir from diary or philosophical journal. I can tell you, reader, about my past life and about my world view also as I ramble along. Why not? It can all come out naturally as I reflect. Thus, unanxiously, for am I not now leaving anxiety behind, I shall discover my literary form. In any case, why decide now? Later, if I please, I can regard these ramblings as rough notes for a more coherent account. Who knows, indeed, how interesting I shall find my past life when I begin to tell it. Perhaps I shall bring the story gradually up to date and, as it were, float my present upon my past. To repent of egoism. Is autobiography the best method? Well, being no philosopher, I can only reflect about the world through reflecting about my own adventures in it. And I feel that it is time to think about myself at last. It may seem odd that one who has been described in the popular press as a tyrant, a Tartar, and, if I recall, a power-crazed monster, should feel that he has not hitherto done so. But this is the case. I have, in fact, very little sense of identity. It is indeed only lately that I have felt this need to write something that is both personal and reflective. In the days when I wrote In Water, I imagined that the only book I would ever publish would be a cookery book. I might now introduce myself. To myself, first and foremost, it occurs to me. What an odd discipline autobiography turns out to be. To others, if these words are printed in the not-too-distant future, there will be, in a superficial sense, no need of an introduction, as they say at meetings. How long does mortal fame endure? My kind of fame, not very long, but long enough. Yes, yes, I am Charles Araby, and as I write this, I am, shall we say, over 60 years of age. I am wifeless, childless, brotherless, sisterless. I am my well-known self, made glittering and brittle by fame. I determined long ago that I would retire from the theatre when I had passed 60. "You will never retire," Wilfred told me. "You will be unable to." He was wrong. In fact, I am tired of the theatre. I have had enough. This is what no one who knew me well, not Sidney, nor Peregrine, nor Fritzy, nor Wilfred, nor Clement when they were alive, could either foresee or imagine. And it is not just a matter of sagely departing on the crest of the wave. How many actors and directors pathetically overstay their welcome. I am tired of it all. There has been a moral change. "All right, go," they said, "but don't imagine that you can come back." I don't want to come back, thank you. "If you stop working and live alone, you will go quietly mad." This was Sidney's contribution. On the contrary, I feel completely sane and free and happy for the first time in my life. It is not that I ever came to disapprove of the theatre, as my mother, for instance, never ceased to do. I just knew that if I stayed in it any longer, I would begin to wilt spiritually, would lose something which had travelled with me patiently so far, but might go away if I did not attend to it at last, something not belonging to the preoccupations of my work, but preciously separate from it. I remember James saying something about people who end their lives in caves. Well, this, here, is my cave, and I have reached it bearing the precious thing that has come with me, as if it were a talisman which I can now unwrap. How grand and pompous this sounds. And yet, I confess, I scarcely know what I mean. Let us break off these rather ponderous reflections for a while. The above observations have been written on a sequence of different days, wonderful, empty, solitary days, such as I remember yearning for, and never quite believing that I wanted so much that I would finally obtain them. I went swimming again, but still cannot discover quite the right place. This morning I simply dived into deep water off the rocks nearest to the house, where they descend almost sheer, yet with folds and ledges enough to make a precarious stairway. My cliff, I call it, though it is barely 20 feet high at low tide. Of course, the water is very cold, but after a few seconds it seems to coat the body in a kind of warm, silvery skin, as if one had acquired the scales of a merman. The challenged blood rejoices with a new strength. Yes, this is my natural element. How strange to think that I never saw the sea until I was 14. I am a skilful, fearless swimmer, and I am not afraid of rough water. Today the sea was gentle compared with Antipodean oceans, where I have sported like a dolphin. My problem was almost a technical one. Even though the swell was fairly mild, I had a ridiculous amount of difficulty getting back onto the rocks again. The cliff was a little too steep, the ledges a little too narrow. The gentle waves teased me, lifting me up towards the rock face, then plucking me away. My fingers, questing for a crevice, were again and again pulled off. Becoming tired, I swam around trying other places where the sea was running restlessly in and out, but the difficulty was greater since there was deep water below me, and even if the rocks were less sheer, they were smoother or slippery with weed, and I could not hold on. At last I managed to climb up my cliff, clinging with fingers and toes, then kneeling sideways upon a ledge. When I reached the top and lay panting in the sun, I found that my hands and knees were bleeding. Since my arrival, I've had the pleasure of swimming naked. This rocky coast attracts, thank God, no trippers with their kiddies. There is not a vestige of beastly sand anywhere. I have heard it called an ugly coast. Long may it be deemed so. The rocks, which stretch away in both directions, are not, in fact, picturesque. They are sandy yellow in colour, covered with crystalline flecks, and are folded into large, ungainly, incoherent heaps. Below the tide line they are festooned with growths of glistening, blistery, dark brown seaweed, which has a rather unpleasant smell. Up above, however, and at close quarters, they afford the clamberer a surprising number of secret joys. There are many V-shaped ravines containing small pools or screes of extremely varied and pretty stones. There are also flowers, which contrive somehow to root themselves in crannies. Pink thrift and mauve mallow, a sort of white-spreading sea campion. A blue-green plant with cabbage-like leaves, and a tiny saxifrage thing with leaves and flowers so small as almost to defeat the naked eye. I must find my magnifying glass and inspect it properly. A feature of the coastline is that here and there the water has worn the rocks into holes which I would not dignify with the name of caves, but which, from the swimmer's eye view, present a striking and slightly sinister appearance. At one point, near to my house, the sea has actually composed an arched bridge of rock under which it roars into a deep, open, steep-sided enclosure beyond. It affords me a curious pleasure to stand upon this bridge and watch the violent forces which the churning waves, advancing or retreating, generate within the confined space of the rocky hole. Another day has passed since I wrote the above. The weather continues almost perfect. I have received no letters since my arrival, and this does seem rather odd. My ex-secretary, Miss Kaufman, kindly detains the diminishing flow of business mail in London. Well, whom do I want to hear from after all, except Lizzie, and she is probably away on tour. I have continued to explore the rocks in the direction of my tower. Yes, I am now the owner not only of a house and a lot of rocks, but of a ruined Martello Tower. It is, alas, only a shell. I would like to restore it and build a spiral staircase and a lofty study room, only, contrary to what is commonly believed about me, I am not rich. My sea house took most of my savings. However, I have a good pension, thanks to darling Clement's business sense long ago. I must save up. Near to the tower I found a pleasing piece of archaeology, which is also evidence that I am not the only person to have discovered it difficult to get out of this sea. In a secret inlet below the tower, and invisible except from directly above, some steps have been cut in the side of the rock, descending into the water and surmounted with an iron banister. Unfortunately, the lower part of the banister is broken away, and the rock face being smooth, the slippery steps are useless except at high tide if there is any strong swell. The waves simply pluck one off. It is remarkable how quietly, firmly powerful my sportive sea can be. But the idea is clearly excellent. I must have the banister extended, and it occurs to me that a few iron stanchions let into the face of my cliff would provide quite enough hand and footholds for the climb, in any state of the tide. I must inquire in the village about workmen. I swam from the tower steps at high tide, and then lay naked on the grass beside the tower, feeling exceedingly relaxed and happy. The tower, I regret to say, does attract the occasional tourist, but I'm loath to put up a notice saying private. This little lawn is the only piece of grass which I own, except for a small patch directly behind the house. This grass, tormented no doubt by the sea wind, is extremely short, its blades spread out in little circular mats of an almost cactus-like toughness. Pink and white valerian grows round the base of the tower, and a kind of purple-flowering thyme mingles with the grass and perches here and there among the rocks on the landward side. I examined this, and also the tiny saxifrage, through my magnifying glass. I wanted to be a botanist when I was 10. My father loved plants, though ignorantly, and we looked at many things together. I wonder what I would have done with my life if I had not been theatre mad. Walking back, I looked into my various pools. What a remarkable amount of beautiful and curious life they contain! I must buy some books about these matters if I am to become, even to my own modest satisfaction, the Gilbert White of this area. I also picked up a number of pretty stones and carried them to my other lawn. They are smooth, elliptical, lovely to handle. One, a mottled pink, elaborately crossed with white lines, lies before me as I write. My father would have loved this place. I still think of him and miss him. It is after lunch, and I shall now describe the house. For lunch, I may say, I ate and greatly enjoyed the following. Anchovy paste on hot buttered toast, then baked beans and kidney beans with chopped celery, tomatoes, lemon juice and olive oil. Really good olive oil is essential, the kind with a taste. I've brought a supply from London. Green peppers would have been a happy addition, only the village shop, about 2 miles, Pleasant Walk, could not provide them. No one delivers to far-off Shroffend, so I fetch everything, including milk, from the village. Then bananas and cream with white sugar. Bananas should be cut, never mashed, and the cream should be thin. Then hard water biscuits with New Zealand butter and Wensleydale cheese. Of course I never touch foreign cheeses. Our cheeses are the best in the world. With this feast I drank most of a bottle of muscadet out of my modest cellar. I ate and drank slowly, as one should. Cook fast, eat slowly. And without distractions, such as, thank heavens, conversation or reading. Indeed, eating is so pleasant, one should even try to suppress thought. Of course, reading and thinking are important, but, my God, food is important too. How fortunate we are to be food-consuming animals. Every meal should be a treat, and one ought to bless every day which brings with it a good digestion and the precious gift of hunger. I wonder if I shall ever write my Charles Araby 4-Minute Cookbook. The 4 minutes, of course, refer to the active time of preparation and do not include unsupervised cooking time. I have looked at several so-called short-order cookery books, but these works tend to deceive. Their 15 minutes, really, in practice, means 30. And they contain instructions such as, make a light batter. The sturdy, honest persons to whom my book would be addressed would not necessarily be able to make a light batter, or even to know what it was. But they would be hedonists. In food and drink, as in many, not all other matters, simple joys are best, as any intelligent self-lover knows. Sidney Ash once offered to initiate me into the pleasures of vintage wine. I refused with scorn. Sidney hates ordinary wine and is unhappy unless he is drinking some expensive stuff with a date on it. Why wantonly destroy one's palate for cheap wine? And by that I do not, of course, mean the brew that tastes of bananas. One of the secrets of a happy life is continuous small treats, and if some of these can be inexpensive and quickly procured, so much the better. Life in the theatre often precluded serious meals, and I have not always in the past been able to eat slowly, but I have certainly learned how to cook quickly. Of course, my methods, especially a liberal use of the tin opener, may scandalize fools and the various people, mainly the girls, Jean, Doris, Rosemary, Lizzie, who urged me to publish my recipes, did so with an air of amused condescension. "Your name will sell the book," they tactlessly insisted. "Charles's meals are just picnics," Rita Gibbons once remarked. Yes, good, even great picnics. And let me say here that, of course, my guests always sit squarely at tables, never balance plates on their knees, and always have proper table napkins, never paper ones. Food is a profound subject, and one, incidentally, about which no writer lies. I wonder whence I derived my felicitous gastronomic intelligence. A thrifty childhood gave me a horror of wasted food. I thoroughly enjoyed the modest fare we had at home. My mother was a good plain cook, but she lacked the inspired simplicity which is for me the essence of good eating. I think my illumination came, like that of St. Augustine, from a disgust with excesses. When I was a young director, I was idiotic and conventional enough to think that I had to entertain people at well-known restaurants. It gradually became clear to me that guzzling large quantities of expensive, pretentious, often mediocre food in public places was not only immoral, unhealthy, and unaesthetic, but also unpleasurable. Later my guests were offered simple joys chez moi. What is more delicious than fresh, hot, buttered toast, with or without the addition of bloater paste? or plain boiled onions with a little cold corned beef, if desired. And well-made porridge with brown sugar and cream is a dish fit for a king. Even then, some people, so sadly corrupt was their taste, took my intelligent hedonism for an affected eccentricity, a mere gimmick. Wind in the willows food, a journalist called it. And some were actually offended. However, it may be that what really made me see through the false mythology of haute cuisine was not so much restaurants as dinner parties. I have long and usually vainly tried to persuade my friends not to cook grandly. The waste of time alone is an absurdity. Though I suppose it is true that some unfortunate women have nothing to do but cook. There is also the illusion that very elaborate cooking is more creative than simple cooking. Of course, let me make it clear, I am not a barbarian. French country food, such as one can still occasionally find in that blessed land, is very good. But its goodness belongs to a tradition and an instinct which cannot be aped. The pretentious English hostess not only mistakes elaboration and ritual for virtue, she is also very often exercising her deluded art for the benefit of those who, though they would certainly not admit it, do not really enjoy food at all. Most of my friends in the theatre were usually so sozzled when they came to eat a serious meal that they had no appetite, and in any case scarcely knew what was set before them. Why spend nearly all day preparing food for people who eat it, or rather toy with it and leave it, in this condition? A serious eater is a moderate drinker. Food is also spoilt at dinner parties by enforced conversation. One's best hope is to get into one of those holes where one's two neighbours are eagerly engaged elsewhere so that one can concentrate upon one's plate. Nope, I am no friend to these formal scenes which often have more to do with vanity and prestige and a mistaken sense of social propriety than with the true instincts of hospitality. Haute cuisine even inhibits hospitality, since those who cannot or will not practice it hesitate to invite its devotees for fear of seeming rude or a failure. Food is best eaten among friends who are unmoved by such social considerations, or, of course, best of all, alone. I hate the falsity of grand dinner parties where, amid much kissing, there is the appearance of intimacy where there is really none. After this tirade, it looks as if the description of the house will have to wait until another day. I might add here that, as will already be evident, I am not a vegetarian. In fact, I eat very little meat and hold in horror the steakhouse carnivore, but there are certain items, such as anchovy paste, liver, sausages, fish, which hold, as it were, strategic positions in my diet and which I should be sorry to do without. Here hedonism triumphs over a peevish, baffled moral sense. Perhaps I ought to give up eating meat, but by now, when the argument has gone on so long, I doubt if I ever will. I will now describe the house. It is called Shrough End. End, yes. It is perched upon a small promontory, not exactly a peninsula, and stands indeed upon the very rocks themselves. What madman built it? The date would be perhaps 1910. But why Shrough? I have asked two of my, so far, very few local informants, the shop lady and the landlord of the village pub, and they both said, but could give no further account of the matter, that Shrough means black. Shrough Schwartz? Most unlikely. I cannot yet discover anything about the history of the house. I never met the person described as an old lady, a Mrs. Chorney, from whom I bought it. The price was not low, and I was also compelled to purchase the almost worthless furniture and fittings. Considered as a house, Shrough End has obvious disadvantages which I was not slow to point out to the house agent. It is mysteriously damp, and the situation is exposed and isolated. There is running water and main drainage, thank God. I have lived without these in America, but no electricity and no heating system. Cooking is by caligas. There are also some oddities of construction which I will describe in due course. The agent, smiling, could see I loved the place and the disadvantages meant nothing. "It is unique, sir," he said. "Yes, it is." The position is inspiring, though, as my village neighbours take pleasure in telling me, it will be cold and stormy in winter time. Little do they realize how ardently I look forward to those storms, when the wild waves will beat at my very door. Since I have been here, now a matter of a few weeks, the weather has been quite distressingly calm. Yesterday the sea was so motionlessly smooth that it supported a whole flotilla of blue flies which seemed actually to crawl upon the surface tension. From the upper seaward windows, where I am sitting at this moment, the view is total sea, unless one peers down to glimpse the rocks below. From the lower windows, however, the sea is invisible, and one sees only the coastal rocks, elephantine in size and shape, which surround the house. From the back door, which is the door of the kitchen, one emerges onto the little rock-surrounded lawn of cactus, grass and thyme. This I shall leave to nature. I am in any case no gardener. This is the first land which I have ever owned. Nature, I note, has here provided me with a rocky seat upon which I put cushions, and a rocky trough beside it into which I put the pretty stones which I am collecting, so that one can sit upon the seat and examine the stones. From the front of the house a path leads along a steep-sided rocky causeway, a sort of natural drawbridge, to what is dignified by the name of the Coast Road. It is a tarmac road, but the kind where grass tends to grow in the middle. It is, even in May, little frequented by motor cars. I may add here that one of the secrets of my happy life is that I have never made the mistake of learning to drive a car. I have never lacked people, usually women, longing to drive me whithersoever I wanted. Why keep bitches and bark yourself? Below the causeway, on either side, there is a wilderness of small rocks, piled higgledy-piggledy by nature and not accessible to the sea. This is a less attractive scene, and not without a few rusty tins and broken bottles, which I must one day climb down and remove. Beyond the road, the humpy yellow rocks, some of them extremely large, appear again, here set in wiry, springy grass and among innumerable flaring gorse bushes. There are also, placed there by man or nature, quite a lot of skinny fuchsias and dense veronicas, all in flower, and some kind of rather attractive grey-leaved sage. Beyond this shrubbery there is a more barren heathland, covered with gorse and heather, and containing treacherous, boggy pools, evil-smelling and full of virulent green and reddish moss. I have not yet explored this inland country. I am not a great walker, and I am absorbed and contented by my seaside paradise. Upon this heath, incidentally, and about a mile and a half from Shrough End, is the nearest dwelling, a place called Amorne Farm. From my upstairs front windows I can see their lights at night. The coast road, if followed to the right, curves round into the next bay, which is invisible from Shrough End territory except at the tower which stands on the promontory. Here, at a distance of 3 or 4 miles, is an establishment called the Raven Hotel, about which I have mixed feelings, since it is a place of some pretension which attracts tourists. The bay itself is very beautiful, being fringed by rather remarkable, almost spherical boulders. It is locally known as Raven Bay, after the hotel, though it has some other name, something like Shahor in the local dialect. Shore Bay? Why? If followed to the left from Shrough End, the coast road passes through a curious narrow defile, which I have nicknamed the Khyber Pass, where the way has been cut through a big outcrop of rock, which here invades the land to a considerable distance. Beyond this there is a very small stony beach. This is the only beach in the area, since elsewhere, a feature which originally attracted me to this coastline, there is deepish water up against the rocks at any state of the tide. Beyond the beach a footpath leads diagonally to the village, which is set a little inland. But if one continues to follow the road, one reaches a very pretty little harbour, with a magnificently built crooked stone quay, all silted up and entirely abandoned. There used to be fishing boats here, I gather, but these now operate only from further north. I sometimes see them upon my otherwise remarkably empty tract of sea. Beyond the harbour, a long and quite broad shelving slope has been cut in the rock to form what is known as the Ladies' Bathing Place. I have seen no ladies there, only occasionally a few boys. The local people hardly ever swim. They seem to regard the activity as a form of madness. In fact, the ladies' bathing place is now so overgrown with slippery brown weed and so strewn with boulders tossed in by the sea that it is scarcely safer than anywhere else. The coast road here becomes a track, unfortunately suitable for motor cars, which climbs up into a wild region which I have not yet had time to explore, where my yellow rocks turn into handsome and quite sizable cliffs. The tarmac road turns inland to the village and beyond. The village is called Narrowdene. The old form of the name was Nerodene, and a handsome milestone upon the coast road retains this spelling. The little place consists of a few streets of stone-built cottages, some hillside bungalows, and one general shop. I cannot get the Times or any batteries for my exhausted transistor radio, but this does not worry me too much, nor am I dismayed by the total absence of a butcher's shop. There is one pub, the Black Lion. The cottages are charming, solidly built in the yellowish local stone, but the only building of any special architectural interest is the church, a fine 18th-century structure with a gallery. I am, of course, not a church-goer, but I was glad to find that there are services, though only once a month. The church is well kept and regularly provided with flowers. The distant sound of bells which I sometimes hear comes, I think, from an equally tiny village lying inland beyond Amorne Farm, where the country is gentler and there is grazing for sheep. There is no rectory or manor house in Narrowdene. Not that it was ever part of my plan to hobnob with the parson and the squire. I'm also glad to intuit that the place is not infested with intellectuals, a hazard everywhere nowadays. To return to the church, there is a most attractive cimetière marine, which evidences a more spacious past than one would expect this one-horse village to possess. Many of the tombstones carry carvings of sailing ships, decorative anchors, and strangely eloquent whales. Could men have gone whaling from here? One stone in particular attracts me. It bears a beautiful foul anchor and the simple inscription, Dummy, 1879 to 1918. This puzzled me until I realized that Dummy must have been a deaf and dumb sailor who never managed to achieve any other identity. Poor chap. Let us now come back again to Shrough End. The façade which looks onto the road is, I suppose, not in itself remarkable, but in its lonely situation is strangely incongruous. The house is a brick-built, double-fronted villa with bay windows on the ground floor and two peaks to the roof. The bricks are dark red. It would scarcely attract notice in a Birmingham suburb, but all alone upon that wild coast it certainly looks odd. The back has been horribly pebble-dashed, no doubt against the weather. An expert could probably date the house from the pale buff-coloured blinds which survive in almost every room, in excellent condition, with glossy wooden toggles on strings, silk tassels, and a lace fringe at the bottom. When these blinds, expressive word, are drawn down, Shrough End, seen from the road, has a weird air of complacent mystery, while within, the yellow light of the blinded room somehow and sadly recalls my childhood, perhaps the atmosphere of my grandfather's house in Lincolnshire. The two bay window rooms I have christened the book room, where I have put my crates of books, still not unpacked, and the dining room, where I store my wine. But I live entirely on the seaward side of the house, upstairs in my bedroom and what I am determined to call my drawing room, and downstairs in the kitchen and a small den next to it, which I call the little red room. Here there is a good fireplace with traces of a wood fire and also a decent bamboo table and bamboo armchair. The walls have white wooden panels on the lower part, above which they are painted tomato red, an exotic touch not matched elsewhere in the house. The kitchen with the Caligas stove is paved with the most enormous slate flags I have ever seen. There is, of course, no refrigerator, which is dismaying to a fish-eating man. There is a large larder full of woodlice. All the downstairs woodwork tends to be damp. I prized up some linoleum in the hall and replaced it with a shudder. There was a salty smell. Is it conceivable that the sea could be rising up through a hidden channel under the house? I suppose I ought to have had a surveyor's report, but I was in too much of a hurry. There is an old-fashioned mechanical front doorbell with a brass handle and a long wire. It rings in the kitchen. The chief peculiarity of the house, and one for which I can produce no rational explanation, is that on the ground floor and on the first floor there is an inner room. By this I mean that there is, between the front room and the back room, a room which has no external window but is lit by an internal window giving on to the adjacent seaward room, the drawing room upstairs, the kitchen downstairs. These two funny inner rooms are extremely dark and entirely empty. Except for a large, sagging sofa in the downstairs one and a small table in the upstairs one, where there is also a remarkable decorative cast-iron lamp bracket, the only one in the house. I shall certainly not occupy these rooms. Later on, by the removal of walls, they shall enlarge the drawing-room and the dining-room. The whole house is indeed sparsely furnished. I have introduced very little of my own. There is only one bed. I'm not expecting visitors. This emptiness suits me. Unlike James, I am not a collector or clutterer. I am even becoming fond of some of the stuff which I complained so much about having to buy. I am especially attached to a large oval mirror in the hall. Mrs. Chawney's things seem to belong. It is my own few, in fact, possessions which look out of place. I sold a great many things when I left the big flat in Barnes and removed most of the remainder to a tiny pied-à-terre in Shepherd's Bush, where I pushed them in anyhow and locked the door. I rather dread going back there. I cannot now think why I bothered to keep a London base at all. My friends told me I must have one. I say my friends, but how few, as I take stock, they really are after a lifetime in the theatre. How friendly and warm-hearted the theatre can seem. What a desolation it can be. The great ones have gone from me. Clement Makin dead. Wilfred Dunning dead. Sidney Ash gone to Stratford, Ontario. Fritzi Eitel successful and done for in California. A handful remain. Perry, Al, Marcus, Gilbert, what's left of the girls. I am beginning to ramble. It is evening. The sea is golden, speckled with white points of light, lapping with a sort of mechanical self-satisfaction under a pale green sky. How huge it is! How empty! This great space for which I have been longing all my life. Still no letters. The sea is noisier today, and the seagulls are crying. I do not really like silence except in the theatre. The sea is agitated, a very dark blue with white crests. I went out looking for driftwood as far as the little stony beach. The tide was low, so I could not swim off the tower steps, and until I can get some handholds fixed, I think I shall shun my cliff, except in calm weather. I swam at the beach, but it was not a success. The pebbles hurt my feet, but I had great difficulty in getting out, since the beach shelves and the waves kept tumbling the pebbles down against me. I came back, really cold and disgruntled, and forgot the wood which I had collected. I have now had lunch. Lentil soup, followed by chipolata sausages, served with boiled onions and apples stewed in tea, then dried apricots and shortcake biscuits, a light Beaujolais. And I feel better. Fresh apricots are best, of course, but the dried kind, soaked for 24 hours and then well drained, make a heavenly accompaniment for any sort of mildly sweet biscuit or cake. They are especially good with anything made of almonds, and thus consort happily with red wine. I'm not a great friend of your peach, but I suspect the apricot is the king of fruit. I shall now go and have an afternoon rest. It is night. Two oil lamps, purring very faintly, shed a calm, creamy light upon the scratched and stained surface of what was once a fine rosewood table, the erstwhile property of Mrs. Chawney. This is my working table, at the window of the drawing-room, though I also use the little folding table which I have brought in from the inner room to lay out books and papers. I've had to shut the window against the moths, huge ones with beige and orange wings, who have been coming in like little helicopters. The lamps, there are four in all, and in good working order, are also Chawneyana. They are handsome, old-fashioned things, rather heavy, made of brass, with graceful opaque glass shades. I learnt to master oil lamps in the USA, in that hut with Fritzi. Two paraffin heaters downstairs remain, however, a mystery. I must get new ones before chillier nights arrive. Last night was chilly enough. I attempted to light a driftwood fire in the little red room, but the wood was too damp and the chimney smoked. I think that in winter I shall live downstairs. How I look forward to it! The drawing-room is still more of a lookout point than a room. It is dominated by a tall, black-painted wooden chimney-piece, with a lot of little shelves with little mirrors above them. A collector's item, no doubt, but it looks a little too like the altar of some weird sect. It has that oriental vegetable look. Before I lit the lamps tonight, I spent some time simply gazing out at the moonlight, always an astonishment and a joy to the town-dweller. It is so bright now over the rocks that I could read by it. Only, oddly enough, I note that I have had no impulse to read since I've been here. A good sign. Writing seems to have replaced reading. Yet also, I seem to be constantly putting off the moment when I begin to give a formal account of myself. I was born at the turn of the century in the town of... or whatever. There will be time and motive enough to prose on about my life when I shall have generated, as it were, a sufficient cloud of reflection. I am still almost shy of my emotions, shy of the terrible strength of certain memories. Simply the tale of my years with Clement could fill a volume. I am very conscious of the house existing quietly round about me. Parts of it I have colonized, other parts remain obstinately alien and dim. The entrance hall is dark and pointless, except for the presence of the large oval mirror aforementioned. This handsome object seems to glow with its own light. I do not altogether like the stairs. Spirits from the past linger on stairs. These lead halfway up via a narrow branching stairway to a surprisingly large bathroom which faces the road, and from which, behind an odd little door, more steps lead to the attics. The bathroom has some good original tiles representing swans and sinuous lilies. There is a huge, much-stained bath on lion's paws with excellent, enormous brass taps. There is no system for heating the water, however. A hip bath in a downstairs cupboard represents, I suspect, the reality of the situation. There is also a notice in a continental hand giving useful instructions about how to make the lavatory work. The main staircase turns inward to reach the space of the upper landing. I call this a space because it is a rather odd area with an atmosphere all its own. It has the expectant air of a stage set. Sometimes I feel as if I must have seen it long ago in a dream. It is a big, windowless oblong, lit during the day through open doors and adorned just opposite the inner room by a solid oak stand upon which there is a large, remarkably hideous green vase with a thick neck and a scalloped rim and pink roses blistering its bulging sides. I have become very attached to this gross object. Beyond it there is a shallow alcove which looks as if it should contain a statue, but empty resembles a door. After this comes the most fascinating feature of the landing, an archway containing a bead curtain. This curtain is not unlike those which exclude flies from shops in Mediterranean countries. The beads are of wood, painted yellow and black, and they click lightly together as one passes through. After the archway come the doors of my bedroom and drawing room. It is time for bed. Behind me is the long, horizontal window several feet up in the wall which gives on to the inner room. As I rise, I am impelled to look towards it, seeing my face reflected in the black glass as in a mirror. I have never suffered from night fears. I was never, that I can recall, afraid of the dark as a child. My mother early impressed upon me that fear of the dark was a superstition from which God-trusting people did not suffer. I hardly needed God to protect me. My parents were an absolute defence against every terror. It is not that I find Shrough End in any way creepy. It is just that, as it now suddenly occurs to me, this is the first time in my life that I have been really alone at night. My childhood home, theatrical digs in the provinces, London flats, hotels, rented apartments in capital cities, I've always lived in hives, surrounded by human presences behind walls. And even when I lived in that hut with Fritzi, I was never alone. This is the first house which I have owned, and the first genuine solitude which I have inhabited. Is this not what I wanted? Of course, the house is full of little creaking, straining noises, even on a windless night. Any elderly house is, and draughts blow through it from gappy window frames and ill-fitting doors. So it is that I can imagine as I lie in bed at night that I hear soft footsteps in the attics above me, or that the bead curtain on the landing is quietly clicking because someone has passed furtively through it. Perhaps this is a foolish moment, so late at night, to choose to approach the subject, but it has come suddenly and vividly into my head. And the reader, if there is one, may wonder why I have not referred again to a horrible experience which I suffered here beside the sea but could not bring myself to describe. It may seem by now that I had forgotten it, and indeed in an odd way I think I had forgotten it, a tendency which is evidence perhaps for one possible view of the phenomenon. Let me now describe what happened. I was sitting, with this notebook beside me, upon the rocks just above my cliff, and looking out over the water. The sun was shining, the sea was calm, as I have described it in the first paragraph of this notebook. Shortly before this I had been looking intently into a rock pool and watching a remarkably long, reddish, faintly bristly sea-worm which had wreathed itself into curious coils prior to disappearing into a hole. I sat up, then settled myself facing seaward, blinking in the sun. Then, not at once, but after about 2 minutes, as my eyes became accustomed to the glare, I saw a monster rising from the waves. I can describe this in no other way. Out of a perfectly calm, empty sea, at a distance of perhaps a quarter of a mile or less, I saw an immense creature break the surface and arch itself upward. At first it looked like a black snake, then a long, thickening body with a ridgy, spiny back followed the elongated neck. There was something which might have been a flipper, or perhaps a fin. I could not see the whole of the creature, but the remainder of its body, or perhaps a long tail, disturbed the foaming water round the base of what had now risen from the sea to a height of, as it seemed, 20 or 30 feet. The creature then coiled itself so that the long neck circled twice, bringing the now conspicuous head low down above the surface of the sea. I could see the sky through the coils. I could also see the head with remarkable clarity, a kind of crested snake's head, green-eyed, the mouth opening to show teeth and a pink interior. The head and neck glistened with a blue sheen. Then, in a moment, the whole thing collapsed. The coils fell, the undulating back still broke the water, and then there was nothing but a great foaming, swirling pool where the creature had vanished. The shock and the horror of it were so great that for some time I could not move. I wanted to run away. I feared beyond anything that the animal would reappear closer to land, perhaps rising up at my very feet. But my legs would not function, and my heart was beating so violently that any further exertion might have rendered me unconscious. The sea had become calm again, and nothing further happened. At last I got up and walked slowly back to the house. I went up the stairs and into the drawing-room, where I sat for some time, just breathing carefully and holding my heart. I could not bear to take my usual place at the window, so I sat at the little table against the wall of the inner room, leaning my head against the wall, and about half an hour later I was able to write down what now appears as the second paragraph in this notebook. During that time, as I held on to myself and breathed and trembled, I managed gradually to think about what had occurred. Thought, rational thought, which had been utterly routed, returned gradually to my rescue. Something had happened, and happenings have explanations. Several possible explanations came before me, and as I began to number and classify and relate them, some relief came, and the awful, unconceptualized terror receded. It was possible that I had simply imagined what I saw. But of course one does not simply imagine anything so detailed and dreadful. It later struck me as significant that the creature had appeared at once as utterly frightful, rather than as very surprising or even interesting. I was excessively frightened. I am a moderate drinker and certainly not an unbalanced or crazily imaginative person. Another possibility was that I had, again, simply seen a monster unknown to science. Well, that was just possible. Or was what I had seen an absolutely enormous eel? Could there be such an eel? Did eels ever rise up out of the sea and wreathe themselves into coils and balance themselves high in the air? I could not think that the thing was an eel. This was impossible. It had a substantial body. I had seen its back. I was quite sure, too, that I could not have seen a mere eel, however large, as this coiling monstrosity through which I had looked at the sky. How far off had the animal been, and how high above the water had it risen? On further reflection, I was not so certain of my first impressions, though I remained sure that I had seen something absolutely remarkable. Explanations in terms of floating seaweed or bobbing driftwood were not